Welcome to the Geographical Podcast, Editor's Picks. I'm Katie Burton, Geographical's Associate Editor. This is a bonus edition of our usual weekly podcast in which we read out three articles from our print magazine or our website, geographical.co.uk. Today I speak with one of the journalists behind an article which was read out in the last episode of the podcast. The journalist is Tommy Trenchard, and the piece was all about the birth defect clubfoot. Tommy is a really exceptional journalist and a regular correspondent for us. Based in South Africa, he reports from all across the African continent and beyond. His article about clubfoot dealt largely with Zimbabwe, but many of the issues he discussed are relevant all around the world, particularly in developing countries. His piece for the magazine was a hopeful, inspiring one, but also in some ways frustrating. Clubfoot is a treatable condition. If tackled early on, a child born with it can go on to have an entirely normal life. However, due to lack of funds and misconceptions about treatment, many babies with the condition don't get treated or don't receive treatment quickly enough. What follows is a life of immense pain and severely reduced opportunities. The good news is that a cost-effective and simple treatment is now recognised as the best way to cure clubfoot. Called the Ponseti method, it involves using corrective plaster casts and foot abduction braces and doesn't involve the need for major surgery. This treatment is being used more widely, and Tommy met children whose lives are being utterly transformed by this method. Sadly, however, clubfoot remains one of the leading causes of disability throughout the developing world. There are an estimated 7.8 million people living with untreated clubfoot, with some 200,000 more being born with the condition each year. And despite recent improvements in treatment rates, in low and middle income countries, 85% of sufferers still don't have access to proper care. Because the condition is normally treated so early in Western countries, most people have never met someone with clubfoot and often don't know anything about it. And this can cause a problem when it comes to raising awareness about the condition in developing countries. I spoke to Tommy to find out more about his experience writing the piece and his thoughts on the people he met and the prospects of those born with the condition today. Don't forget you can hear his entire piece read out on the previous edition of the podcast. You can also read it on our website, geographical.co.uk, and it was originally published in the February edition of our print magazine. I started by asking Tommy how he heard about this story and what got him interested in reporting on it.
I'd seen clubfoot a few times living in West Africa. It's somewhere where there's not a lot of treatment options, but I'd never really kind of paid much attention to it as a condition in its own right. And it was actually through a contact I'd worked with, who had been working on a different kind of health program in Uganda a few years ago. And she'd moved to a charity that was working on clubfoot, and she reached out to ask if it's something I'd be interested in covering, and just saying that it was something that people so rarely hear about in the media, despite being such a massive global issue. And so, yeah, I started looking into it a bit, and it did seem like just a hugely underreported topic, one that is affecting millions and millions of people around the world, but that a lot of people have never even heard of or most people in Western countries have certainly never seen. That was kind of the beginning of it. And then ended up traveling to two countries, Zimbabwe and Cambodia, to see the kind of different dynamics in both, and a lot of similarities. But the story I wrote for Geographical focused on Zimbabwe in particular, and a few clubfoot patients there and the people treating them. But Zimbabwe was, I think, an interesting place to look at because it's seen a massive increase in the rates of clubfoot treatment over the past 10 years. And it's kind of an example of what can be done and how, with a little bit of work, a little bit of funding, a little bit of extra attention, it's possible to actually make a massive difference.
And that's actually something that I thought was so interesting about this piece, because so often when we cover diseases, the key issue is that they're incredibly hard to treat or to cure. Whereas with this one, there is a cure and it is a simple one. And in some ways that made it quite an inspiring read, because here's something that we can actually eliminate, and fairly simply from a scientific point of view. But on the other hand, there's an element of frustration with that because we could eliminate it and we haven't because of lack of funds. Did you experience that sort of conflict of emotion when writing this?
Oh, 100%. It's just amazing to watch these kind of young lives being completely transformed through this treatment. And yeah, I mean, it works so well that 95% of them, I mean, you would never even know they'd had clubfoot as a baby. They'll just live completely normal lives. But on the other hand, to know that 85% of people born in the global south with clubfoot are still going untreated, and their realities just could not be more different. In a place like Zimbabwe, for example, so if clubfoot goes untreated, the condition becomes so much worse, especially once people start putting weight on it, when they start moving around as toddlers. And by the time they're halfway to their teens, they really can't function. I mean, can find it very hard to kind of live a normal life. And there are no facilities that cater for people with disabilities in these countries, or very few at least. And a large percentage end up unemployed, kind of socially isolated, and life can just be a real struggle. So to know that, yeah, there are so many, I mean, I think every year there's something like, I think over 200,000 new cases around the world, and 85% of those are still going to end up living with that disability, despite the fact that there is this very comparatively simple cure, was definitely very frustrating. So as you say, it was a mix of quite inspiring and a bit depressing.
And as you point out, it's such a small amount of money, relatively speaking, that could actually completely eliminate this, which I would hope would actually inspire people to donate if there was a campaign around this, because it is nice to know if you donate that your money could really make a difference.
Yeah, 100%. I think I mentioned in the story, but there was one study done a few years ago that suggested that I think a really comparatively very small amount of money could entirely eliminate clubfoot disability around the world. And I mean, we're talking just a tiny fraction of what's been spent on similar drivers of disability and other birth defects. So it really does feel like something that it's not an intractable problem, or it shouldn't be. And yeah, I mean, as a journalist, you always kind of hope that your articles will help to kind of trigger some positive change. And often that doesn't seem to be the case. You can be shouting into the void a bit and the situation goes on unchanged. But yeah, with this one, I mean, if some people read it and decide to make a little donation to any of the charities around the world who are working to fight clubfoot, I think that would be great.
Another issue I thought would be really interesting to discuss is that the very first family you meet in your article, when their baby was born with clubfoot, the parents believed that it was the result of some kind of curse. And these sorts of beliefs seemed quite widespread. So I was interested to hear in your view on this and what the best thing to do is, because the problem with clubfoot is that any delay in treatment is really detrimental. And some parents were spending a long time going to different types of healers, trying to find a cure before seeking out the medical doctors. So is the best thing to do to try and discourage those kind of beliefs, or does that risk disrespecting them? And if so, is there a better way to try and encourage people to seek out the medical response straight away?
So I think those beliefs are really widespread in a lot of places, a lot of parts of the world. And speaking to the kind of medical teams, and particularly the ones focusing on advocacy and the fight against clubfoot, well, what they're always saying is you really can't change people's belief systems, and perhaps you shouldn't. And they can be a real obstacle to getting kids into treatment. But the most effective way to convince people is to show them. So kind of the more people they're treating, and the more they're managing to get that message out there in communities, the more effectively they'll be able to reach the people who are still going untreated in the country. So I know a lot of people are using social media, YouTube videos. It's a very similar situation in Cambodia, the belief in karma is very strong. And well, one thing that's quite sad about it is that mothers tend to get blamed when their children are born with clubfoot in both countries that I worked in, because there's this belief that they must have done something, either in Zimbabwe, that they must have done something sinful in the past or been unfaithful, or in Cambodia, that they must have done something in a past life that has led to this misfortune. But yeah, the doctors, there's kind of a big movement to try and publicize the success stories so that people know that this really is a problem that is quite simple and there is a simple medical response to it. And it's kind of it, or it should be a bit of a snowball effect where the more people are treated, the more people know somebody who knows somebody who's been treated, then the more likely they are to come and bring their child into a clinic rather than a traditional healer or herbalist or what have you.
Do you think it's fair to say that coming from Western countries where religion is more often than not a declining force, we can sometimes underestimate what an influence it does have on people in other countries? In this case, when it comes to health and medicine, but also just in wider areas of life.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I've been living in different parts of Africa for the last 12 years now, and in a lot of places, particularly in rural areas, but not exclusively, belief in kind of the occult or spiritual beliefs of various kinds still are a huge force in the day-to-day life of millions. In West Africa, in Sierra Leone, where I lived for 4 years, it was yeah, absolutely massive part of life, and even high-ranking politicians had their chosen traditional healer who they would go to ahead of election time, whenever they had problems that needed solving. I had one friend who was a traditional healer, and he worked for a lot of powerful politicians, and he'd ended up with, I think, five SUVs and a four-story house and about six iPhones that have been given to him for in return for his services by officials in the government. And so it's absolutely an incredibly widespread thing in a lot of places. And it's a complicated area, but in this instance, it certainly can have quite a negative impact on the ability of medical practitioners to reach the patients who really need them. Because also with clubfoot, it's to an extent it's a race against time. When a child's born, the ligaments and tendons in their legs and feet are at their most elastic, and they say you should start treatment really in the first, ideally in the first few weeks, if not in the first few months. And that will, if you start in good time, everything should go smoothly 95% of the time. But the longer parents wait, the harder it becomes to correct. And so, yeah, if a family spends a few months trying different traditional healers, and by the time they get to a clinic, perhaps the child's feet will have become so kind of badly twisted that it's yeah, just a lot harder to treat. And that, in fact, was the case with patients. One of the main character I follow in my geographical story. So she didn't get into treatment until she was nine, by which time her condition had become so bad. She was walking in this incredibly painful way where one of her feet had become angled, like it had basically done a 180, and she was walking on the very top of her foot with the sole pointing upwards. And that had in turn dislocated one of her kneecaps, and life was just hell for patients. Then, I mean, another few years and perhaps there might not have been any hope at all. But starting treatment at that age, she was able to, yeah, doctors performed a series of surgeries, and she still has a really long way to go. Movement is still a struggle for her. She has to use crutches if she's walking more than a few yards. But her medical team is confident that she will make that recovery in the end.
And her story, although sad, was actually also a really positive part of your article. Did you get the impression that this treatment was already changing her life and And did she feel that herself?
So it's already hugely changed her life. There are so many things she can do now that she can't, that she couldn't do before. Yeah, but I mean, also growing up with that condition has had such a massive impact on her as a person. I think it's made her, she has this kind of quiet inner strength and resilience that you can imagine she must have had to draw on to get through all the hardships over them in her early years. But it also, I mean, her experiences also made her very kind of shy outwardly. And so when you meet her, like, it's not as though she seems incredibly excited about the next step, but, you know, she's fully aware that for the first time in a long time, she has options now, possibilities are opening up. I think she knows she's going to have to keep working incredibly hard to get there, and the road ahead will still be difficult for quite a while. But yeah, she's definitely aware that she's facing a very different future now than she was a few years ago.
Your story for Geographical was really focused on Zimbabwe, but you did also travel to Cambodia to look at what was happening with Clubfoot there. So I was interested to see if the situations in the two countries are very different or if you found similarities.
So in the end, I was kind of surprised by how similar the dynamics were in both countries. You had the same kind of stigma often attached to the mother and the child, the same obstacles to treatment, which were lack of health, lack of access to health facilities, lack of money for transport and in some cases for treatment, and lack of awareness of the condition, what it was, the fact that it can be treated. So really, yeah, the people I was speaking with were often struggling with a lot of the same things. And so it was, yeah, the situation actually seemed remarkably, that the parallels were really quite clear. And both countries are now actually making really positive strides towards towards reaching those last patients who still aren't receiving treatment.
That was Tommy Trenchard talking about his piece, originally published in the February issue of Geographical magazine. Thank you for listening to the Geographical podcast. If you're interested in learning more about Clubfoot or the charities working to eliminate it, Tommy was situated with the Zimbabwe Sustainable Clubfoot Programme, which is supported by Miracle Feet, a US charity working to eliminate clubfoot disability around the world. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, and you can find this story and many, many more on our website, geographical.co.uk. And why not consider subscribing to our print magazine, Geographical, packed full of stories about our planet, its people and its animals, and illustrated with superb photography.